tell us what happens at a disestablishment ceremony.
Well, this morning we're here in beautiful Suffolk, Virginia. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, will be here to preside with General Odierno, who's the commander of U.S. Joint Forces Command. And what will effectively happen is we'll stand down the four-star command today. So General Odierno will roll up and pull down his flag for U.S. Joint Forces Command, which will formally disestablish the command. And as you pointed out, this is the first combatant command, of which we are one of four functional. There are six geographic combatant commands. It's the first time in our nation's history that we'll disestablish a combatant command.
And why do it? Just a recap for our audience.
Well, last year, as you may recall, on the 9th of August, Secretary Gates made the recommendation that U.S. Joint Forces Command was in a position to potentially disestablish. At that time, we worked closely with a team that we put together here at Joint Forces Command with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and with the Secretary of Defense's staff to take a look at which functions really were unique and had to be retained, and then look at how we could best do this to promote efficiencies. We had, this command was very, very complex. If you looked at Joint Forces Command a year ago, we were 28 different organizations with about 5,700 employees, about 1,500 military, 1,600 government civilian, and about 2,600 contractors. And what made it even more complex is the funding resources for this joint command came through 10 different federal resource sponsors for about 32 different program elements. So it was a very complex command, and it had grown four times since 2001 without the command really having the opportunity to completely right-size itself. So, you know, as we look at what has transpired over the year, I mean, the president made a decision on the 6th of January that Joint Forces Command would disestablish. There were a series of briefings, the Virginia delegation, the Virginia governor, the communities. There were a lot of people involved in looking at what the right answers were. And we came up with a plan for how to take the most important functions, things that weren't done anywhere else within the federal government. And those pieces were retained. The end state is the four-star command will disestablish. But about half the workforce of that 5,700-person workforce is actually being retained and going to be reassigned to a multitude of different federal agencies.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the people, but also the idea of jointness itself is not going away. We still have to have cooperation and joint activity among Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marine Corps. So how will those doctrinal issues be addressed in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. Joint Forces Command was stood up in 1999, and its initial charter was to help provide joint forces, make recommendations which forces would support the warfighter, facilitate and oversee joint training for major exercises and mission rehearsal events, as well as looking at the integration of all things material and non-material for the government, so to make sure things like databases, command and control equipment were borne jointly. Those are still very, very important tasks. And, of course, as Joint Forces Command has evolved, it took on additional mission sets like concept development, doctrine writing, lessons learned, the ability to send personnel to quickly stand up joint task forces. All of those functions, and when you looked at Joint Forces Command a year ago, there were 1,200 discrete deliverables and functions that the command provided. As we've gone through this analysis, 80% of all of those functions are still going to be done. They're just going to be done under different commands. So the idea of jointness for today and tomorrow is definitely going to continue.
So there remains that need for the different forces to be working together to continue to share that information and those skills.
Absolutely. When you look at the, the what's next beyond JFCOM, I mean, part of our effort here is to make sure the communication of what a disestablishment means. When you hear the word closure or shuttering of Joint Forces Command, the whole thing's not going away. I would characterize it as really a realignment and reassignment of those critical functions, specifically the joint force training, the joint force providing, the doctrine writing, understanding lessons learned, and, of course, integration of all systems for command and control for material and non-material solutions. All of those functions are going to continue, including the groups of people that go out to help stand up joint task forces for operations and humanitarian assistance around the world. We still are going to be doing all of that.
We're speaking with Rear Admiral Walter E. Carter, Jr., the commander of U.S. Joint Forces Command's Joint Enabling Capabilities Command. And I wanted to ask you about the physical facilities. There was a lot of talk, especially in the local newspapers. I think, and this is what concerned the governors, the governor involved also in Virginia, was that perhaps there would be some economic dislocation as a result of this disestablishment. So what happens to the offices and the buildings and whatever else you had down there?
Yeah, a year ago, we occupied about 21 buildings between Norfolk and Suffolk here in the Hampton Roads area. That encompassed about 3,800 employees between military, civilian, and contractor. In the final end state, we're going to consolidate to four major buildings, one of which is the largest. You mentioned this Joint and Coalition Warfighting Center. This is a very large building here that is where a lot of the experimentation, concept development, doctrine, and the biggest thing is the modeling and simulation for running training events occurs. So that building will still be occupied. We're going to consolidate everything that's in the Suffolk Lakeview Parkview complex into that one building. And then in Norfolk, we'll occupy three of the previous 17 buildings. And all of the rest of those buildings that will be vacated, most all of those are on Navy property. We'll turn those back over to the Navy, and they'll make the ultimate determination as to who fills those. All high-quality buildings. We have we're very optimistic that all those buildings will be filled with folks.
And you had mentioned that the people who work there would be reassigned. Is there any timeline for that? Are they already starting to be farmed out to other areas? And how much say do they have in where they get to go next?
Well, I would tell you, the workforce here at Joint Forces Command has been absolutely amazing. I mean, you can imagine the churn and how potentially upsetting it could be when you hear that everything's going to go away. So they had to be very patient as we worked through final decisions, who was going to go where. You know, almost all of civilians, all the civilians here in the Hampton Roads area were offered opportunities, and their positions were retained. We did ultimately lose about 100 civilian positions across all of Joint Forces Command across the United States. We lost about 400 military billets across the command, and then, of course, we did a lot of right-sizing with those contractor numbers down from about 2,600 to about 600. But as we realigned all of those, about 1,600 of the 1,900 people that are going to be retained here in the Hampton Roads area will be reassigned working for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And specifically, the largest director that will show that will be the J7, the Director for Joint Training. They will plus up about 1,000 people working out of this Joint Coalition Warfighting Center here in Suffolk, Virginia.
And, of course, cost-cutting was the original impetus for this whole disestablishment. Given what you've said, is there actually measurable cost savings as a result of the new structure?
Absolutely. You know, a year ago when the announcement was made by Secretary Gates, our budget was $988 million for fiscal year 11, just under $1 billion. As we've gone through and looked at not only what we would stop doing, but the right sizing of all the functions that we were doing, in other words, keep the capability but maybe reduce some of the capacity, we determined that the functions that would move to the Joint Staff could be done for under $400 million, and all of the other enablers, there's quite a few other subcommands who do very specific tasks, that would be done for a little over $100 million. So the overall budget of what remains is just over $500 million, yielding a savings of well over $400 million when it gets to steady state starting in fiscal year 12. So over the next 5 years, it's a savings of $2 billion, pretty significant.
And very briefly, as this command closes after 12 years of existence, is there a twinge of sadness? I mean, was it there long enough to develop its own culture and sense of history that commands can get? Was that the case for Joint Forces?
I think so. As you look at how the command evolved, I mean, obviously it has naval roots going back to, United States Atlantic Command, and then it was the Joint Forces Command in 1999. I would say that the workers here are the ones that really put the meat on the bones for the Goldwater-Nichols Act. And that legacy, I think, will continue with what remains with this workforce as most of them transition to working for the Joint Staff. As you mentioned, the mission of jointness isn't going away. We've proven how much better we've become at that in the two wars we've been engaged at. And ultimately, the advocate for jointness is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that will continue. So the work that was done by the folks here at Joint Forces Command has a lasting effect. Its legacy will be what it has done and what it will continue to do for the joint mission, for that joint warfighter.